full. Ticket prices are high, with airlines charging up to $8,000 a ticket, according to a letter from Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer sent to the State Department urging it to do more to help Americans safely flee. I'm Christina Onnestad reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia, here is Friday, September 27, 2024. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on the rising tide of international fascism and how anti-immigrant sentiment has become one of the main tools by purveyors of authoritarianism. And in order to have this conversation, we're going to spend the hour with Nikki Duda, who's a Chicago-based writer, editor, and researcher. She comes back to the show. Welcome back to the show, Nikki Duda.
Hi, thank you. Glad to be here again.
It's good to have you with us again. And I'll tell you the same thing I said before we started recording here, that today is one of those conversations where we could start by discussing Haitian migrants or Venezuelan migrants or xenophobia taking place in England or in Turkey or anywhere else in Europe and not be wrong on the starting point. But for the sake of our audience here in the U.S., let's begin with the debate, the presidential debate that took place this month, and the horrendous litany of misinformation and disinformation with regards to Haitian migrants that we've been hearing for some time now. I'll tell you right off the bat, and this is the same thing I told the audience last week, that as the son of Salvadoran immigrants, there's a part of me that doesn't really want to give this story that much oxygen because of the misinformation and because of the racism and xenophobia that goes behind it. And I don't want to give it oxygen in that manner, you know. But with that said, considering where the direction both the U.S. and many other parts of the world are unfortunately going to, How does recent information against Haitian migrants in the U.S. sort of serve as a microcosm to the rise of fascism that we've seen globally, not just in the U.S., but beyond the U.S. and beyond this particular story as well?
So this is such a big question, and hateful rhetoric towards foreigners and immigrants, or at least those viewed as foreign, are intrinsic to fascism. In Nazi terms, there can be no master Aryan race without Jewish people, Slavs, leftists, disabled people, Roma people, queers, etc. So we've seen massive waves of disinformation and misinformation targeting immigrants and refugees. And a lot of that has been directed especially at the Latino community and really at Venezuelan refugees. But Haitians in particular have been targeted with a pernicious kind of racism that traces back to the Haitian Revolution, which was a successful uprising of enslaved people that ended slavery and French colonial rule there by the early 1800s. And Jacobin ran a really good article on this earlier this month by, I'm not sure if I'm saying their name right, Allende Bonifacio, about how that racism really started as a way of discouraging similar revolts in other parts of the Americas, which still had slavery at that time. And he argues that Republicans are using that same vein of rhetoric, which we all know what it is, to fire up panic around immigration. So there are these kinds of ridiculous accusations that tap into that very old racism. And just for the record, they are completely baseless. There's no evidence for any of them. And J.D. Vance directly said, quote, "If I have to create stories so that the American media actually pays attention to the suffering of the American people, whatever that means, then that's what I'm going to do," end quote. And then the LA Times also ran a story about how the Nazis actually used kind of a similar tactic. So this is a quote from that article. "The Nazi Party's chief racist ideologue, Alfred Rosenberg, kind of did this around the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, an anti-Semitic tract wholly fabricated by officials in Tsarist Russia. In 1934, Rosenberg wrote that the issue was less the so-called authenticity of the protocols than the inner truth of what is stated." And then you have Goebbels, who said in 1924 in his diary, and he was Hitler's chief propagandist, "I believe in the inner but not the factual truth of the protocols." But you still have people quoting this as kind of like evidence of Jewish control of the world, these kind of racist conspiracy theories against Jewish people. But I think to understand why anti-immigrant and anti-foreigner, anti-quote-unquote other-ism is such an effective tactic for fascism, we should discuss kind of how it fits into that larger definition of what is fascism, right? And so I kind of pulled a little thing from an essay, a really famous essay by Italian thinker Umberto Eco from 1995. You maybe know this essay, Fascism or Eternal Fascism, 14 Ways of Looking at a Black Shirt. And so I'm just going to share a few quick excerpts so we can see how these baseless accusations against Haitians fit into an outline of how fascism can manifest. So he writes, "If we still think of the totalitarian governments that ruled Europe before the Second World War, we can easily say that it would be difficult for them to reappear in the same form in different historical circumstances. I do not think that Nazism in its original form is about to reappear as a nationwide movement." And you kind of hear people say this a lot, right? You know, we're not going to have that kind of World War II moment again. So this kind of, why are people fear-mongering around fascism and all that? But then he goes on to say, "Is there still another ghost stalking Europe, not to speak of other parts of the world? Fascism became an all-purpose term because one can eliminate from a fascist regime one or more features, and it will still be recognizable as fascist. But in spite of this fuzziness, I think it is possible to outline a list of features that are typical of what I like to call fascism or eternal fascism. These features cannot be organized into a system. Many of them contradict each other and are also typical of other kinds of despotism or fanaticism. But it is enough that one of them be present to allow fascism to coagulate around it." And then he outlines these 14 points that he sees as elements of this so-called eternal fascism. And so some of them that we can see crop up in these anti-immigrant conspiracy theories are the cult of tradition. Oh, they're changing the character of our nation. They're changing what it means to be an American. They're against our values. They are uncivilized. They're not like us. Rejection of modernism. So kind of like this irrational rejection of intellectualism, of Enlightenment ideas. The idea that disagreement is treason. And you see this kind of in videos on social media of people kind of doing man on the street interviews with Trump supporters and saying, Joe Biden said this thing that is actually a quote from Trump, and they'll disagree with it if you tell them that Biden said it. And then the person is kind of like, oh, wait, no, I messed up. That was actually Trump that said that. And then they're like, oh, then it's fine. That's why. This fear of difference, which he describes as an appeal against intruders. And he says that Ur-fascism is racist by definition. And so for a long time in Europe, this point was reserved for Jewish people. But as one of my college professors used to say, the Holocaust made anti-Semitism unfashionable. So it's kind of changed in character. Appeals to a frustrated middle class, a class suffering from an economic crisis or feelings of political humiliation and of being frightened by the pressure of lower social groups. So in the US and in parts of Europe, North Africa, the Middle East, in Latin America also, that has taken on the character of feeling that your place, your jobs, your status in society is going to be usurped by refugees. Obsession with a plot, contempt for the weak, machismo, and selective populism are some of the other elements. And selective populism, this one is maybe relevant to the MAGA movement, is he says that Ur-fascism must be against the, quote, rotten parliamentary governments. Wherever a politician casts doubt on the legitimacy of a parliament because it no longer represents the voice of the people, supposedly, we can smell Ur-fascism.
Drain the swamp.
Yes, exactly.
Well, thank you for crystallizing that right there, because this is precisely why I want to discuss this, despite my trepidations that I mentioned earlier, because there's a part of the population and even in corporate media that would dismiss this as disinformation and no nuance beyond that. But we need that nuance to understand the parallels that you just described right now between what's going on right now as far as rhetoric by the Republican Party and how it parallels that of what took place almost a century ago in World War II in Europe. Now, last year, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis made a series of attacks on the state's public education system, which included the distortion of African-American studies, banning of books, and banning of LGBTQ studies. And this whole distortion of history was so bad, if you recall late last year, that there was even justifications to slavery afterwards, which was one of the results of this distortion of history in the state of Florida. I tried to do a comprehensive episode last year about all the anti-LGBTQ legislation that took place during the course last year, which began in places like Florida. But because there were so many copycat legislations in so many states, there was a time where it was just hard to keep up with all the anti-LGBTQ, anti-trans legislation that was just popping up throughout the country week by week, day after day. So my question to you here is, to what extent do you see the rise of fascism with an increased attack on public education, not just exclusive to LGBTQ rights, but to some of the things that we saw, especially in Florida early last year?
So part of that, I think, still echoes definition. His essay on Ur-fascism really can illuminate some of why these particular things, why attack these particular groups? Why do the far right and fascists choose certain people as others, certain groups as others? What's the logic behind that, basically? And so he lists machismo in his kind of elements of Ur-fascism. And one of the ways that that can manifest is as a rejection of any kind of quote-unquote irregular, abnormal, obviously I'm not actually saying that, kind of expressions of sexuality. So that explains that. But then he has this other point that he defines as newspeak. And he says, all the Nazi or fascist school books made use of an impoverished vocabulary and elementary syntax in order to limit the instruments for complex and critical thinking. But we must be ready to identify other kinds of newspeak, even if they take the apparently innocent form of a popular talk show. So essentially, we're talking about what's happening in Florida with the attack on kind of essentially critical thinking in public schools is an effort to wipe out the vocabulary that allows us to talk about diversity, to talk about different ways of being, to express critical thought. We can't talk about those things if we can't name them, if we don't have the vocabulary for them, if we don't have the words to engage with these topics, it becomes impossible. And in that same essay, he goes on to tell a story about the day or the week, whatever, the dictatorship ended in Italy, where he's from. His mother asked him to go buy a newspaper, and he got to the newsstand and saw that suddenly these different front pages were mentioning parties that he had never known existed. Communist parties, other moderate parties, other right-wing parties. And he says the message on the front page celebrated the end of the dictatorship and the return of freedom. Freedom of speech, of press, of political association. These words, freedom, dictatorship, liberty, I now read them for the first time in my life. I was reborn as a free Western man by virtue of these new words. And he says, we must keep alert so that the sense of these words will not be forgotten again. Or fascism is still around us, sometimes in plain clothes. It would be so much easier for us if there appeared on the world scene somebody saying, I want to reopen Auschwitz. I want the black shirts to parade again in the Italian squares. Life is not that simple. Or fascism can come back under the most innocent of disguises. Our duty is to uncover it and to point our finger at any of its new instances every day in every part of the world. And so that's, I think, an element of what is happening to the education system and to an extent in universities as well and around the debate around what's happening in Gaza is to limit the scope of permissible thought, of permissible speech, of permissible critical thought, essentially.
Yeah, we're suddenly going to talk about Gaza during the course of the conversation, but going back to Florida, like I said before, there were so many copycats last year, not only in regards to what I mentioned earlier with regards to LGBTQ rights, but assaults on public education and even reproductive rights as well. And it sort of follows the same tack that you just described just now. So recently, Project 2025 has received a lot of attention for a variety of reasons in corporate media and even during the course of this election cycle. And I have to say that earlier this year, I had the pleasure of speaking with Heidi Beirich, who's one of the co-founders of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism. And we discussed Project 2025. This was around March and April, early this year. And at the time, it really wasn't on anyone's radar. That certainly changed since then. And it's gotten the attention for all the right reasons. But I have to say that the name is sort of a misnomer because this project is not exclusive to 2025. And it's not even exclusive to Trump, the individual. Anyone who looks at a summarized bullet point presentation of Project 2025 will notice that Trump's name is not even mentioned at all in this project. And it's so sweeping as it pertains to immigrant rights, LGBTQ rights, reproductive rights, a complete distortion and change of the federal government, among other things. So for those who may not be looking at it at a more nuanced way, how much does the project draw inspiration from certain authoritarian leaders in Europe? Because considering when I spoke to Heidi Beirich earlier this year, she said that there was a lot of inspiration with regards to authoritarian governments in Europe in this project that was by the very admission by the architects of this project.
So for a little background, Project 2025 is an initiative of the right-wing think tank, the Heritage Foundation, which is in the U.S. And despite the fact that Trump has really tried to distance himself from Project 2025 as people have kind of woken up to what's included in this more than 900 page document. Some of his allies have had critical roles in creating it and writing it, so people can decide what that means for themselves. And it aims to consolidate power in the executive branch of the U.S. government. It calls for mass deportations. It would be dangerous for the press. It would be dangerous for people interested in exercising any of their First Amendment rights. And these are not only authoritarian proposals, because we can use authoritarian to describe also Joseph Stalin, for example, who was an authoritarian and who had many, many, many people killed under his regime, but was not necessarily a fascist, right? But some of these proposals included in this document they're fascistic. And especially if we're using Umberto Eco's definition of ur fascism that we kind of outlined above. And it kind of follows the path that the Third Reich took in consolidating its power in Germany during World War II of, okay, we're in power now, let's make sure we stay here, kind of thing. Let's make sure that these changes are affecting people in this country for years to come. And so I also wanted to kind of go back to Trump's role in this, because CBS News last month in August 2024 did an analysis of Project 2025 versus Trump's rhetoric, his policies over, you know, the last several years. And it said that it identified, quote, at least 270 proposals in Project 2025's published blueprint that match Trump's past policies and current campaign promises. It also has quite a bit of overlap with his Agenda 47 as well. So even if we believe that he doesn't have any intention on implementing any of the plans proposed in Project 2025, there's a lot of common ground and definitely some of the elements of fascism as Eco describes it. So he proposes housing homeless people in massive tent cities, formally recognizing only two genders, pushing education in schools around the so-called traditional family, mass deportations, an end to birthright citizenship, travel bans for some countries, and halting admission for refugees into the United States, which would, you know, some of those things are things that he attempted to do during his first term, but some of them would be even bigger changes.
This is precisely why I wanted to have you on the show, just as a form of education to this rising tide of fascism, as I described earlier in the show. And I'm going to take a break here, but before I do, I want to bring some relevancy to Project 2025 to the WPFW audience, especially those listening to us in Northern Virginia, because according to Axios, 11 of the Republican lawmakers who are part of Project 2025 or who are authors or supporters of it, 11 of them have ties to the state of Virginia, particularly in Virginia's education system. And we're talking about the university systems in places like James Madison University and even George Mason, which is not that far here from Washington. So like I said before, we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Nikki Duda, who's a Chicago-based writer, editor, and researcher, and we're discussing the rising tide of fascism throughout the world. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Te quería recordar que hoy es una luna muy importante, encima del zodíaco, y hay que quemar. Hoy hay que armar algo para quemar. Hacete un fueguito donde sea, una velita. Así que fíjate bien que quieres quemar.
Mirando, mirando, mirando. Te están publicando, publicando, publicando. Todo está más siendo algo. Un movimiento social desde abajo.
That was Sara Eve, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone that you can also follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And, of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about the rising tide of fascism globally with Nikki Duda, who's a Chicago-based writer, editor, and researcher. And right now, I want to bring our attention to last month as this interesting situation took place in northern England where anti-immigrant riots took advantage of misinformation online to attack a shelter for asylum seekers in northern England. This was based on a stabbing tragedy that took place around the same time last month. And this is an interesting story to the American audience because going back to the Haitian story that we mentioned earlier, there's been so much misinformation towards that community in Ohio that there was the threat of violence in that small town of Springfield, Ohio, where schools had to be shut down and people had to be locked down in their homes because of the threat of violence that was being purveyed in social media because of the misinformation that myself and Nikki mentioned earlier in the show. And to a certain degree, there may be a parallel here between that story here in the U.S. and what took place in Northern England. Either way, the result is the racism and xenophobia that's pervasive not only here in the U.S., but globally as well. So, Nikki, do you see recent events like these as indicative to a broader rise of the fascist movement centrally rooted in xenophobia? Am I even correct to draw those two parallels considering, you know, we're obviously talking about two countries, but the underlying thing here is misinformation and fake news towards communities that have otherwise no power or control to push back otherwise. Although I will say that as we have this conversation this week, that a grassroots Haitian organization is filing a lawsuit against Trump and Vance. That's the most they can do. That's the best they can do under these circumstances. But otherwise, this seems to be another continuation of the targeting of groups that don't have political power to push this rising tide of misinformation being pushed against them.
I think you are totally right to draw that parallel. On the one hand, you have misinformation, which could be something like someone's mom reposting an article about COVID-19 vaccines that was written by her neighbor on Medium, something like that. Someone drawing an incorrect conclusion, and then it kind of becomes trending online. And then you have disinformation, which is an intentional campaign. We hear a lot about Russian disinformation campaigns, for example, in the U.S. about a variety of subjects. And it could not just necessarily Russian. It could be a corporation pushing a specific line, anything like that. So I think that is also at play when it comes to some of this anti-migrant rhetoric, especially on social media. And in the UK, what happened, if I'm not mistaken, was that there was a stabbing attack and people started spreading information, misinformation, that the suspect was an asylum seeker. It turned out that he was actually born in the UK, but that did not stop people from attacking hotels where asylum seekers were being housed. And we all saw the images, I'm assuming, British people barricading the doors of a burning building with massive dumpsters to keep people from escaping, which to me was, I'm sure to most people, was horrifying because, you know, you're not only taking out your rage, but it shows this kind of something deeper than that moment of rage. You know what I mean? But also, at the same time, one of the things that was encouraging about that, despite the fact that we didn't really see police intervening too much, maybe they were surprised, maybe they were outnumbered, maybe they didn't feel like putting themselves in harm's way, I don't know. But we saw a lot of anti-fascists and regular British people coming out and fighting with these fascists in the street, protecting people, protecting refugees, protecting asylum seekers. And I think that was really encouraging. But you kind of see this pattern of misinformation sparking violence. And so, for example, maybe we'll talk about this in a bit, but for example, in Turkey, there was an incident where in Turkey there are 3 million Syrian refugees. They host the most Syrian refugees of any country. And back in at the end of June, a Syrian man was arrested for assaulting a 7-year-old Syrian girl. And this kind of resulted in a massive wave of violence against the Syrian community, against Arabic speakers, against foreigners, against Afghan people who are refugees in Turkey. And when you go online and look at the videos of some of these incidents, the comments of these videos are just full of absolute nonsense. And that nonsense was coming from a far-right party in Turkey called the Zafer Partisi, the Victory Party, which is known for just spewing the most vile anti-refugee rhetoric. I mean, even in the U.S., I think people would be shocked by some of the things that this guy says, the head of the party. And that was then repeated and kind of marketed to a larger audience by the opposition party here, the liberal opposition party. So kind of like Turkey's version of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, you know what? This is very important because it kind of breaks the unspoken presumption that this rising tide of fascism is exclusive to just the U.S. and through most of Europe, if not all of Europe. But this breaks that presumption, correct?
Yes. In the U.S., I think we have a way of thinking about racism and xenophobia and machismo that are very tied to men and white Americans. But really, we need to kind of complicate that as these are issues of white supremacy. They're issues of patriarchy. They're issues of dominance, of nativism, of nationalism, those kinds of things. So, for example, in the U.S., you have people of color who have been engaging in extremely anti-migrant rhetoric and behavior, while others, for example, in the Latino community, it's very common to have people who are extremely anti-Black.
Yeah.
And then you have some Latinos who are born in the U.S. who support mass deportations and the MAGA movement, and poor people of color who believe immigrants are taking their jobs, etc. And then you can kind of like plug working class white Americans into that formula and say, okay, this is kind of a version of a similar thing. It becomes a sort of fight to keep yourself from ending up on the bottom rung of the ladder, so to speak. And so the people one step up from the bottom end up being the ones upholding these fascistic movements like MAGA, or upholding this kind of anti-migrant sentiment. So to go back to Umberto Eco, he kind of describes this as appeals to a frustrated middle class. And I think that's kind of what we see across the world, honestly. Right now, we can see this in rising attacks on refugees, not only in the UK and across mainland Europe, but in North Africa against sub-Saharan Africans, in Latin America against Venezuelans, against Afghan refugees in Pakistan. And yeah, in Turkey, what happened back in June carried into July. Rioters attacked businesses, cars, homes belonging to Syrian people. A teenage boy was stabbed and killed by a group of young people. There's video on social media of another young Syrian guy being pulled off of a moving motorcycle. There's video of a man kind of like waving a knife in the air at two, I believe, Saudi men who were just sitting in a cafe in a kind of fancy neighborhood speaking Arabic. And then while all of this was happening, someone leaked the personal information, albeit a bit outdated, of the roughly 3 million Syrian refugees living in Turkey. And it was just on social media until the government could kind of finally get it off there. But it was out there for people to download. And the government did make a lot of arrests. But this is, it's kind of the same kind of deal. People want someone to blame for economic problems that are a result not of immigrants, not of foreigners, not of hosting refugees, but of capitalism and of certain policies, we can say.
Yeah, I feel like the authoritarian direction that Turkey has taken and the political party's vitriol towards Syrian refugees is an hour-long conversation in and of itself, because there's so much more nuance that that story deserves as well. But it certainly lends itself to the general issue that we're discussing here with regards to the rising tide of fascism. Just last week on a show, I did a conversation here with the people of CISPIS about the authoritarian direction that Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele has taken the country and the continued state of exception over there. And Nayib Bukele is, by and large, a Trump supporter. And to a certain extent, he's already putting into practice things that are in the infamous Project 2025. And I always find it so ironic that he would be such a big supporter of Trump and would implement things like what's in Project 2025 when the country as a whole has been demonized so many times by the same Republican Party here in the U.S. It makes no sense other than the pursuit of authoritarian motives. And there's no other explanation about as to why that is. It's just so bizarre to try to look at it any other way. So, you know, we've gone this far into the conversation and not really hit too much into the issue of freedom of speech. And I think the massacre that's taking place in Gaza right now, that's how I describe it. I think that gives us a good segue into the issue of freedom of speech, because do you see the punishment of students and professors who protest the war on Gaza as another extension of fascism in the U.S., at least, as it pertains to freedom of speech? Because if you recall around this time late last year, that even in corporate media, in places like MSNBC, there were leaked documents or leaked conversations of producers trying to silence or limit the voices of the organization's Muslim reporters. And this is indicative to a larger issue of censorship in MSNBC over the years, going all the way back to the U.S. invasion of Iraq back in 2003. But going back to the original question here, do you see this as an extension of fascism in the U.S. at the very least as it pertains to freedom of speech?
Definitely, I would say yes, but I think there are several indications of that kind of fascistic tendency in the U.S. and beyond in regards to this issue. Obviously, one of them being the fact that this is even happening, the fact that Israel, despite the fact that its own people are saying, we want a deal, we want the hostages released, is declining to engage on that front or declining to come to an agreement on that front, which we've seen reports indicating that that is what's happening. But I see the fact that Washington is funding Israel's, the way I would describe it, genocide in Gaza as evidence of U.S. fascism. Even the most recent polls show that most voters do not support this. They don't want to continue sending weapons. They don't want to foot the bill for a genocide. They certainly don't want the U.S. to back a government that is consistently bombing civilians. And if we really had democracy, this would not be happening. Congress is supposed to be representative of what the American people want. That's what democracy means in the representative sense. That's not what we have, it would appear.
You just reminded me before you continue that even this week, as we have this conversation, the Israeli military raided the offices of Al Jazeera and ordered them to be banned and essentially banned them from the airwaves with regards to their coverage of Gaza. But please continue.
Yes, they keep a tight media environment in Israel. But I mean, a pro-Palestine stance has been an issue for years for people in the academy and journalism in, you know, kind of these quote unquote intellectual professions in the U.S. and the crackdown on activists, on First Amendment rights, critical thought. These are, as we've discussed, fascistic tendencies. And there's an academic who years ago, I can't even remember, maybe 2009 or 2011, something like that, Stephen Salida, who is, I believe, a professor, Native American studies, not anything directly related, well, related but not directly related to Palestine. I believe he's Palestinian American, but I could be wrong there. He's definitely of Palestinian descent, and he was given a post at U of I, the University of Illinois, in Champaign, offered a post, and then it was taken away from him, I believe, over tweets related to Palestine. And this was years ago. So this is not anything new. And it's also not something that's just happening in the U.S. If you hop on TikTok or hop on Instagram, you can see footage of German police attacking pro-Palestine, anti-genocide protesters in a, which to say as an American feels very odd, but in a way that was shocking even to me. You know, our police are not exactly known for being gentle, and so that's saying a lot. I was in Berlin in March for Women's Day, and during a march, I saw a woman chanting, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," which you're not allowed to say in Germany. They consider it anti-Semitic, which is another issue. But she maybe weighed like 120 pounds at most. And after she said that chant, several large male police officers kind of like ripped her violently out of the march in a totally unnecessary way, totally unnecessary amount of force for such a small person. And she also wasn't resisting. So there was really no excuse or reason for it other than the fact that they didn't like what she was saying. They were told, you know, that they're enforcing this policy of what she was saying is not okay. And then kind of back to the U.S., we also have direct violent attacks on Palestinian Americans inside the United States, not just protesters, but the young boy in Illinois who was stabbed and killed, of course, by his landlord 26 times, yes, by his mother's landlord. A man in Vermont shot three college students, paralyzing one of them. I believe they were all wearing keffiyehs. And then in Texas, another man stabbed a young guy who I believe was also a college student who had a Free Palestine banner on the truck that he was in Austin, Texas.
Those are very important points to make because it just shows that this form of fascism, as it pertains to how it targets Palestinians, is not exclusive to Republicans per se. It speaks more about institutional racism and by extension, institutional fascism as well. Because I'll say this, and I'll stand alone in saying this, but it always gets under my skin whenever there's a Arab or Muslim guest on one of the big cable networks here, or somebody in support of Palestine. And one of the first questions that can be asked sometimes is, do you condemn the actions of Hamas from October of last year? The obvious question is, of course, you know, but it irks me to hear that question because it almost comes across as a purity test as to whether or not you are deemed worthy to be in corporate media, to be interviewed, and to discuss the issue at hand. And I would say this as a Salvadoran who to some degree is on the outside looking in on this whole issue that's been taking place in Gaza for almost a year now, is that, look, once upon a time, the FMLN was considered a terrorist organization by the U.S. Once upon a time, the ANC in South Africa was considered a terrorist organization. Even an organization as small as Fretilin, which was the independence movement in East Timor against Indonesia, was considered a terrorist organization. The point being is that in an imperfect world, there's no such thing as a perfect resistance movement. It doesn't exist. And even if it did, in the case of Gaza, it's very clear that the current Israeli administration has no interest in peace or any type of nonviolent resolution here. What do all those groups have in common? They were reflections of a wave of resistance against whatever incarnation of fascism was during their particular times, during their particular time periods. And so this is why I want to have this conversation with you today. And there's no, it seems like there's no end to the sort of demonization that Palestinians face. And we could easily cut and paste, you know, the demonization of Palestinians with Haitians or Venezuelans And it just shows you sort of the unfortunate direction that the country is taking, to put it politely. I want to see, what are your thoughts on the rhetoric of the great replacement theory being normalized in both politics and mainstream media? I know you hit upon this to a certain degree during the course of this conversation, but we haven't even mentioned Christian fundamentalism or Christian nationalism during the course of this conversation. And it's one of those things that is quietly underlying some of these things, certainly some of the motives of the people who are, say, for example, purveyors of Project 2025 or any of its components. But it's something that needs to be addressed nonetheless.
Yeah, so definitely, and especially the role that the Christian evangelical movement in the U.S. plays in, you know, in support of Israel also. But as we talked about earlier, fascism is anti-intellectual. You cannot both think critically and believe this trash, because usually it's absurd and irrational. And the Great Replacement Theory essentially contends that white people are being systematically replaced by, you know, some mysterious elites that we're usually told are Jewish, but depending on your beliefs, they're replacing white people, wherever they happen to be, with immigrants or people of color, to the point of extinction of the so-called white race. And it's definitely referenced a lot in far-right circles. And there have been examples of these types of people trying to piggyback, kind of going back to the pro-Palestine movement, trying to piggyback off of genuine pro-Palestine activism, because they're looking for an avenue for their anti-Semitism. These people do not care about Gaza. They don't care about Palestine. They want to be anti-Semitic. And there is, you know, anti-Muslim and anti-Jewish incidents, violence, rhetoric are both on the rise in the United States and in other places right now. And so the Great Replacement Theory, as absurd and as ridiculous, totally unfounded, all of that as it is, it was cited by the attackers in the 2022 shooting that killed 10 people in a predominantly black area of Buffalo, New York, in the 2019 mass shooting at a Walmart in El Paso, Texas, which is on the U.S.-Mexico border, that killed mostly Latino people, as well as the 2019 attacks on two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, which killed 51 people. So this ridiculous conspiracy theory has, just between these shootings, resulted in the deaths, in the killings of more than 80 people, in the murders of more than 80 people. And in 2017, in Charlottesville, Virginia, we saw these dweebs in khakis carrying tiki torches chanting, "You will not replace us," and "Jews will not replace us." And it's absurd and it's laughable, but it's also, as we can see, extremely dangerous. Again, this conspiracy theory is totally unsubstantiated, but if we kind of refer back to the outline of fascism that we were discussing, we can see that it ticks a lot of those boxes. It keeps the far right in the mindset that they're at a permanent state of war. They're at perpetual war. It stokes fear of difference, especially of immigrants. It's traditionalist because it tells us that too many foreigners will change the character of the country. It's a plot for people to become obsessed with, kind of like a conspiracy theory that, you know, you're constantly being targeted. It attempts to appeal to that frustrated middle class of working people who are being told that immigrants are ruining the economy and taking their jobs. And let's not forget Trump trying to accuse immigrants of taking quote unquote black jobs, whatever that means, when really it's just, you know, it's rich people doing this. It's capitalism. It's the economy as it's set up right now. And this is where anti-intellectualism also comes in and kind of circles back to restrictions on freedom of speech in universities, in the media, in schools, because if you think critically, you'll see that this doesn't make sense. You'll see that there's no evidence for this. You'll see that even economically, that this doesn't make sense, that immigrants in general bring a benefit to the countries that they arrive to, that refugees especially, that can be true. And you'll see that economic crises and inequality are inherent to a certain kind of economics. You'll see the class element and you'll be forced to think in those terms. And that's the biggest fear of the wealthy class, of the 1%. And so we get these sorts of disinformation campaigns trying to trick working people into kind of preventing them from catching a glimpse of the man behind the curtain, so to speak, to divert their attention elsewhere. Don't think about this. Don't disagree with this. We'll protect you, but, you know, divert your hatred that way. And don't pay attention to losing your own rights to attacks on your own freedoms, because those are coming, whether these kind of MAGA types want to believe that or not. You know, that kind of trending TikTok sound of, I never thought that the leopards would eat my face. You know, you never think it's coming back. You never think that it's coming back for you, but it will. It will affect those people also. That's kind of the trap that has been laid with this great replacement rhetoric. And you see it in the way that you see it not only in the United States, not only in New Zealand, but around the world in the way that people are reacting to having groups of foreigners or people who are construed as foreigners. So like in India against Muslim people who are from there, and yet they're being
Argentina,
in Pakistan, in North Africa, in Turkey, Hungary, Poland, Serbia, everywhere, France, Germany, Mexico, the United States. It has permeated through a lot of different places, and it's extremely dangerous. But I think we need to remember that it's also absurd and kind of marry those two things of laughing at it on the one hand, but also trying to take it seriously. Because if there's one thing that fascists hate, it's being made fun of.
Well, you know what? I think that would be a good way to end this conversation. Normally, I would ask for a conclusion, but the November elections are just around the corner. And much like 2020, I have a lot of trepidation as to what's going to happen next, regardless of what the results are going to be, what direction the country is going to take. And even if, is there going to be another January 6th like last time? Who knows? There's a lot of trepidation going on. So it's really hard to make a conclusion as to what's going to happen next or to put an optimistic bow to this. But at the very least, it's important to have this conversation now in the lead up to the election. And so with that said, we've been speaking with Nikki Duda, who's a Chicago-based writer, editor, and researcher. As always, Nikki, it's fun and informative to have you on the show. Thank you for being on the show with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
WPFW News in Washington, and WBAI in New York. I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Friday, October 4th. Here are some headlines. Israel carried out a series of massive airstrikes overnight on Lebanon, hitting suburbs of Beirut and cutting off the main border crossing between Lebanon and Syria for tens of thousands of people fleeing Israeli bombardment. Israel's health ministry said yesterday at least 2,000 people have been killed in the last year of Israeli attacks on Lebanon, including at least 127 children, and most of them in the past 2 weeks. More than 1.2 million Lebanese have been displaced. At least 4 hospitals across southern Lebanon are now out of service as a result of Israel's bombardment, according to Lebanon's state-run news agency. This comes as hospitals are overwhelmed by a surge of casualties as attacks intensify. The World Health Organization says Israel's attacks killed 28 health workers in just one 24-hour span and made it impossible for the WHO to deliver a large shipment of trauma and medical supplies to Beirut. In related news, Israel has sworn it will retaliate for Iran's missile barrage on Israel on Tuesday, which involved more than 180 ballistic missiles and was largely thwarted by Israel's air defense systems with help from the United States. Yesterday, President Biden told reporters in Washington that the idea of Israel striking Iran's oil in retaliation for Tuesday's attack was in discussion, as reports indicated that Israel is determined to strongly respond, but had not yet decided on the scope and timing. Iran's foreign ministry warned today that if Israel carries out an attack on Iran, there would be retaliation. And in the Iranian capital, Tehran, the country's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, led Friday prayers and delivered a speech where he praised the country's recent missile strike on Israel and said Iran was prepared to conduct more strikes if needed. In other news, striking dock workers agreed to go back to work last night after reaching a tentative agreement with port operators for a 62% wage increase. The International Longshoremen's Association said in a joint statement with the COVID-19 pandemic and enriched their investors as wages failed to keep pace with inflation. And the U.S. economy added over 250,000 jobs in September, a larger amount than expected by economists and significantly higher compared to the month prior. The unemployment rate dipped for the second straight month to 4.1%. The data suggests the U.S. labor market is still strong despite sustained high interest rates and a few months of pessimistic data. Most new jobs in September came in the food service, healthcare,